dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are often inclined to look, if at all, very superficially at one of the most important battlefronts in that war, Latin America. At a moment when there is an awful lot happening there, from demonstrations and elections and protests and corruption on an enormous scale and drug trafficking and Americans being murdered in Mexico, there's a man who we turn to regularly to take it all aboard, and he covers that beat brilliantly as the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also a financier with Caracas Capital. His name is Russ Dallin, and we're very pleased to have him with us today. Russ, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure and a learning experience to be with you.
Well, we certainly find it that way. And Russ, thank you for the work you do covering all of these very important topics. I want to drill down in the shortness of time we have with you on Venezuela for an update with you there. It seems as though the struggle for the future of Venezuela still goes on between Nicolas Maduro, Chavez's handpicked successor, the despot who no longer has a mandate but nonetheless continues to rule, and Juan Guaido, recognized by quite a number of countries, including our own, as his legitimate successor and replacement. What's the latest on the ground there? The condition of the people and their economy, of course, but also the fight for the future of Venezuela.
Well, it continues to be a mess, unfortunately, and the forces of darkness in the guise of the Cuban-controlled and narco-trafficking Maduro regime still maintains its control of the country, despite the best wishes of the United States and 60 other nations that represent that recognize Guaido as the legitimate interim president of the country.
So the effort to bring down the government of Nicolas Maduro has in part turned to American courts to try to assure that the opposition has the resources it needs to mount an effective opposition to him. Tell us about the case involving Citgo's assets and what the prospects are for it.
So as part of recognition of the Guaido government, we also recognize them in the United States as both the legitimate ambassador of the U.S. to the U.S. of Venezuela, but also that they would have control of any assets in the United States that are state-owned property, like PDVSA's, the state oil company, which owns Citgo in the United States. That battle is being played out because they also, unfortunately, the Chavistas and Maduro regimes, as much money as they made from narco-trafficking and the sale of trillions of dollars worth of oil over the last 20 years, also increased their debt and borrowed against it and expropriated from great American companies like ConocoPhillips and Owens Illinois, the largest glass manufacturer in the world, a glass bottle manufacturer, ExxonMobil. And so all of those companies are now, you know, a decade and a half later, have had their days in court and have been awarded huge judgments. ConocoPhillips has an $8.5 billion award for the expropriation of three of its oil companies. Crystalex, a gold mining company, has a $1.4 billion judgment. Owens Illinois has a $600 million judgment. And they're looking for assets to get paid back as those things have worked their way through the courts. So there is a battle to get the assets that are in the United States that we'd like to go to the Guaido regime and help them recover for the country. But also, you know, people deserve to be paid for all the corruption and things that the bad things that the Chavistas have done over the last couple of decades.
I guess it's too early to say how this is going to come out, but Juan Guaido and his team are anxious to retain control of those assets, I take it. And it raises a question. One of the other stories that's broken recently is the degree to which the Maduro government seems to be propping itself up through money laundering operations, including in your hometown of Miami, Russ Dahlin. What do we know about that and who's involved in it?
Well, one of the byproducts of the United States trying to help clean up Latin America and bring the rule of law to Latin America has been us cracking down specifically on bribery and all of the corruption that goes by. One of the reasons for the decay of Venezuela's economy and oil operations is because of corruption, not just stupid communist economic policies, which had designed it, destroyed it, as well as kind of economic nationalism that they expropriated from all of these powerful international companies and with all the, you know, technological know-how that they have, but also the corruption that was bred out of allegiance to the country. And so the courts in Texas and Miami have pretty much taken the lead in kind of exposing a lot of this corruption. And the district attorneys have been bringing suits for billions of dollars in stolen money. Stolen in this kind of bribery, like, well, I'll sell you a power plant for $1 billion that's only, you know, only worth, you know, $250 million, and we'll split the $750 million. And so that there was of the last two decades, there's just a phenomenal amount of all of that economic wealth. When the oil went up to $150 a barrel in 2007 and 2008, all of that wealth was just destroyed, like a horde of locusts had descended on Venezuela and stolen, and is now in beautiful houses in Coral Gables or Wellington, Palm Beach, and in Texas, and in Madrid, castles in Madrid.
To the great detriment, of course, of the people of Venezuela. And let me just close, Russ, because, of course, you mentioned the term communism. It's not often employed these days, but there is a certain sentiment among young Americans who have been inculcated with it by cultural Marxists in our academic institutions over the past decade or two, that, you know, the wave of the future is socialism. Just a quick word on how that's worked out in Venezuela, beyond what you've already described in terms of ripping off people and expropriating technology and companies and so on.
Chavez was politically savvy and internationally savvy. He never called it communism. He called it socialism for the 21st century. Same merde, but just in a different bottle, basically. But here you have a sad example for the rest of the world to see, as if we didn't know from North Korea and South Korea the differences, or East Germany and West Germany in our times, to see the differences between capitalism and communism. Here you have Venezuela, a country with the largest oil reserves in the world, more oil than Saudi Arabia. And not just oil, but beautiful beaches, beautiful people, rich natural resources besides oil, iron ore, copper, coltan, strategic metals that are necessary for computers and all these kind of things, the largest gold reserves in Latin America. And you put in Cuban-style communism in that country, and in two decades, you bring it to bankruptcy. And that's essentially what's happened.
Yeah. Russ, we have to leave it at that. I'm so sorry to say we are out of time, but come back to us again soon with further updates, if you will. God bless you, my friend. Good to talk with you.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Diana West, a tremendous contributor to the public policy debate in general and specifically to our situational awareness, as the military says, about, well, the struggles for the free world in this war inside the United States. And she has written several really important books that touch on various aspects of that problem, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread, Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. And Diana, who better to talk to about what's happening with the impeachment Fandango, for want of a better term, than you, considering what you have done to study the ideological drivers behind what is, let's be clear, an ongoing anti-Trump conspiracy now doing business as an impeachment inquiry. Give us your sense of where things stand at the moment.
Where things stand at the moment is, as you say, a continuing conspiracy to overturn the president, now centered on Capitol Hill. The more I watch, the more we learn about the secret processes, the witnesses that we can't know the identity of, namely the whistleblower, so-called, the more it keeps reminding me of what we used to study as Soviet show trials, where evidence was concocted, where witnesses were compromised and pressured or hidden away, where lawyers were not allowed to counsel their clients. All of these totalitarian techniques were used to orchestrate, to produce a theatrical type production of a trial, of an inquiry. And the defendant is always guilty from the beginning to the end. So this is something familiar to us from the totalitarian past, and now we have it here.
You know, I'm reminded of the famous line from the Queen in Alice in Wonderland, verdict first, trial after. And it seems Absolutely. As though that with a Soviet technique thrown in is very much at work at the moment. You mentioned the identity of some of the witnesses. Of course, the president is rather insistent that we need to know the principal accuser at the moment, namely this so-called whistleblower. Where do you come down on getting individual's identity disclosed, Diana? Does that worry you from the perspective of, honoring and facilitating whistleblowing as an important check on abuses? Or do you think that this is basically the practice of being able to confront your accusers required under the Constitution?
Well, yes, it's certainly the latter, although I think what's most important to keep in mind, and there's so much going by us, so it's hard to keep a lot of this in mind, but until a certain point in September, Adam Schiff, who's running this whole fandango, as you say, was very intent on getting the whistleblower out there and promising that he would come before the Congress and the American people in terms of...
Must be heard from, I think, was the way he put it.
Yes. Then, as soon as reporters started to put together this notion that this same said whistleblower, quote unquote, who is a leaker, in fact, was actually working with the Schiff people to coordinate the entire series of events leading to this so-called whistleblowing act, suddenly Adam Schiff wanted to pull him from sight and protect his identity and keep it from the American people and come to this notion of the sacred anonymity of this person whose testimony is supposed to sink the President of the United States, overturn the 2016 election, and subvert the 2020 election. Well, that's a very important person in American history, and of course he should come forward, and of course the press should name him. We've seen his name. The name we've seen, Eric Ciarmarella, we have seen this name appear in print. We have not seen the media discuss this, go further than this. We have not seen the Congress, the Republicans, demand this person.
Paul Sperry, of course, being a notable exception at Real Clear Investigations, did put that forward. Diana, what do we know about this Ciarmarella fellow based on Paul's reporting, I guess, principally, that bears on his integrity, or at least the actual value that might be imputed to his testimony?
Well, we only know that he worked for Joe Biden, and we only know that this was at a time when this entire corrupt Burisma organization was up and running with Hunter Biden on the case, on the board, that is. I mean, we only know that there is tremendous affiliation between this so-called whistleblower and the corruption of Ukraine that goes back to the former vice president's family and his interests. So this is a very partisan person, as we are being led to believe, and that in and of itself makes his testimony that much more important. It's not to say that a partisan person cannot be a whistleblower and have facts and have a true story, but given the politicization of this process from before Donald Trump was elected, given the utter subversion of every agency, every security agency, every intelligence agency that we have seen in order to go after and destroy the Trump movement and his presidency, of course, we should be very leery of such a person and need and demand, and you would think he would want to make his case if it is true and strong and straight to the American people, because it's that important. This is not a moment for theatrics and smoke and mirrors, and that's, of course, what we're getting.
Diana West, one of the other credentials Eric Termella has evidently is that he was detailed over to the White House to work for Joe Biden, I think with Ukraine as part of his portfolio, if I'm not mistaken, by, wait for it, John Brennan, who has himself, of course, been a prime player in this campaign against President Trump, the anti-Trump conspiracy, as you call it. And I wonder, Diana, again, you've been a student of totalitarians and the radical left, most especially in their practices here as well as abroad. Just give us a quick short course on the practice of deflection or projection. And could it be that a man who had worked for Joe Biden and who probably knew intimately his exposure to charges of corruption in connection with his own family affairs in Ukraine and his own quid pro quo could have been determined to try to make sure that everybody's eyes were, in fact, as I say, diverted onto Donald Trump's putative phone call that had a quid pro quo associated with it?
Well, I think this entire process has been one of serial deflections, and this is only the latest one. I actually find the whole Ukrainian exercise, even though it is focusing the attention of the Congress at this point, to be one giant deflection from what really is the frame-up, what really is the scandal, and what is the heart of the anti-Trump conspiracy, going back to the original cast. Let's call it the Broadway cast. The Ukraine is the roadshow to the Broadway cast of the Russian collusion propaganda hoax. I mean, this is where we get back to the real players, going from the Obama White House, the John Brennans, James Comeys, the Christopher Steeles, going back to the Clinton campaign, the Nellie Orrs and Bruce Orr. I mean, that whole cast of characters has never been brought to book, well, of course, but is now escaping our gaze, is moving out of the spotlight, thanks to this whole Ukrainian uproar, which I still maintain was at least, I think, in large part triggered because they saw the day after the Mueller hearings that Donald Trump made a phone call to the president of Ukraine and was asking about CrowdStrike and the DNC server. This, to me, is where we still have to keep our focus, even though people understandably are kaleidoscopically diverted by all this other stuff.
CrowdStrike and the DNC server, again, very quickly, remind us what that refers to and why it is so central to the anti-Trump conspiracy.
This becomes the moment where we see the Russian collusion hoax, perhaps the original deflection, Donald Trump as Putin's puppet, emerged during the campaign, during the Democratic National Convention of 2016, when the break-in, supposedly, of the DNC server that started to reveal all the things the press should have been reporting about the corruption of Hillary Clinton and the DNC against Bernie Sanders and others began to be revealed through WikiLeaks. This becomes the moment where they had to turn Donald Trump into the puppet of Putin, who did this in order to essentially protect Hillary from her own deeds, her own crimes, and it's been the point at which we could never enter into this conspiracy, but it is the most important part because it shows the absolute conspiracy by all of these agencies, the FBI, the CIA, etc., to hide their own roles in the creation of this Russia hoax. And we are not there yet, and we get farther and farther away, even as Donald Trump clearly has it on his mind that this is what he wants to expose.
But what you're getting at, as we've talked about on this program on a number of occasions, is that CrowdStrike was the DNC contractor that was engaged to evaluate the nature of this breach of the DNC servers, came away concluding that it was from Russia, that was taken as gospel by the FBI, which did not look into the server itself forensically. The intelligence community handpicked at people working for John Brennan, that is, not the entire intelligence community, saying, oh, yes, they verily, this is a Russian break-in to the Mueller and then to the Congress and so on. The main point of this, Diana West, just to wrap it up, is we are still watching play out this anti-Trump conspiracy. There still is very much an ideological component to its motivations, and we are still being denied the whole truth and nothing but the truth, thanks most especially to the machinations of Adam Schiff and the Democratic inquiry that he's leading. Much more to come on all of this. I wanted to ask you about the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, but that will be for next week. Diana West, in the meantime, thank you. Keep up the good work. I know at Epic Times and, of course, at dianawest.net, and we'll talk with you next week. Next up, we will speak with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry about Grid Down in California. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's my distinct pleasure to say we're joined by a friend and colleague of many years, one of the men I admire most for his dedicated public service over decades, some of it in the Central Intelligence Agency, where he was an analyst for many years, some of it on Capitol Hill. We served in senior staff positions on, among other things, the House Armed Services Committee, but most especially for his long service on the Electromagnetic Pulse Threat Commission, a blue ribbon panel that was established by Congress back in 2001, and until fairly recently provided us a succession of extraordinarily detailed and invaluable reports on the vulnerabilities of the most critical of our critical infrastructures, namely our electric grid. His name is, of course, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is frequently a guest on this program, among many others. One of his most bravura performances was on a program that Mark Levin aired and then re-aired, as I recall, on Fox News. Peter is the author of numerous books of great value on this and related subjects, including Apocalypse Unknown and Electric Armageddon, and the newest one, Blackout Wars. He is the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, among other things at the moment, and always a valued friend and colleague, and especially welcome guest. Peter, thank you for being here. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Peter, you and colleagues of yours, notably Dr. William Graham, the chairman of that EMP Threat Commission for many years, as well as the former director of Central Intelligence, Jim Woolsey, have authored pieces recently about the lessons to be learned from what's going on in California at the moment that has involved the blackout of millions of people out there. Tell us what on earth is happening, as well as, you know, what the causes are.
PG&E, which is one of the largest electric utilities in the United States and one of the largest electric utilities in California, has been responsible for causing wildfires over the past several years because of its failure to invest in public safety and to do very obvious, simple safety measures like vegetation management, as the industry calls it, you know, which is removing trees that threaten to down power lines, or replacing aged power line towers, many of which date back to the 1920s, and can collapse in high winds and cause fires. And so a lot of the wildfires in the past have been sparked, causing great destruction and deaths. In 2018, for example, due to a power line, a wildfire that was sparked by these power lines, the town of Paradise was completely incinerated and 85 people killed. And there were deaths and public damage of a disastrous nature in the years preceding that. And yet PG&E never took any steps to to correct these problems and instead try to escape public liability by declaring bankruptcy. Now, currently, PG&E, having failed to engage in these basic safety precautions, is trying to cope with the wildfires in California to stop its by de-electrifying the power lines, putting blackouts, deliberately imposed blackouts affecting millions of people when there are high winds in the area, you know, because they never fixed the problems with their electric grid. The government of California, I have to add, shares equal responsibility for what's happening there, because Governor Newsom and the California Public Utilities Commission, which is dominated by Democrats, have given higher priority to dealing with the so-called existential threat from climate change, and they forced PG&E to put billions of dollars into wind farms and solar energy, you know, into their green energy agenda, which has shortchanged the basic, simple, obvious public safety precautions like vegetation management and the like. The real lesson to be taken from California, though, is that PG&E, you know, has all of this disaster has unfolded while PG&E has been under several layers of regulation from the California Public Utilities Commission, regulation by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, you know, which supposedly, you know, puts out mandates that are supposed to be followed by the 3,000 electric utilities in North America, and regulation by the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And all of this confirms that the EMP Commission was right, that the current regulatory structure over the electric power industry is not adequate to protect against bigger, more complex threats like EMP and cyber warfare, because the system is basically corrupt, and because the Department of Energy and Department of Homeland Security are pursuing a doomed-to-fail strategy of public-private partnership, where government is the junior partner, and they basically trust and to defer to the alleged expertise of the electric power industry to cope with, well, whether it's protecting vegetation management all the way up to nuclear EMP attack. And obviously, if they can't do vegetation management, they can't be trusted to protect us against a true existential threat like EMP or cyber warfare.
Yeah. This is a very troubling assessment, of course, Peter, but I'm afraid based on what we've witnessed to date, both on the part of PG&E and on the part of the regulators who are supposed to oversee them, but generally, as you say, defer to them. It's kind of a case of regulatory capture that is putting not just millions of Californians at risk, but as it is similarly practiced towards other utilities elsewhere around the country as a whole. And this brings me to this important piece that you and Bill Graham and Jim Woolsey authored in Real Clear Defense the other day, and I really commend it to our listeners. Peter, talk us through what the president's executive order was designed to do to address such problems, and where you think things stand at the moment with respect to its faithful implementation.
Yes, on March 26th of this year, President Trump issued an executive order basically designed to protect our nation from the existential threat that is EMP. And it was designed to implement the recommendations of the EMP Commission. I'd like to think that I personally had something to do with its passage, you know, because when President Trump was running for president in the Iowa caucuses, thanks to you, Frank, I was able to brief him on EMP. And after the briefing, you know, he was so appalled by the fact that the U.S. government had permitted this existential threat to continue and had not addressed it, that he said, you know, don't worry, when I'm elected president, we're going to knock their heads together and solve this problem. And that's basically what his EMP executive order does. It puts all the departments, relevant departments and agencies on the hook, DHS, DOE, the Department of Defense, forces them to work together, you know, to come up with plans to protect very not just the electric grid, but all the critical infrastructures of the United States, and that is on a pretty short deadline. For example, 1 year after the executive order was signed, next March 26th, the U.S. government, these various departments and agencies, are supposed to deliver to the White House a assessments on technologies that are available to protect our critical infrastructures, recommendations on policy things that can be done to compensate utilities to pay for the protection so that the president will then be in a good position to quickly get the electric grid protected. Unfortunately, while the executive order is excellent, the government departments and agencies, the deep state, which never wanted the same people who are in charge of implementing the president's executive order at DOE and DHS, never took the EMP threat seriously in the first place. These are long-term bureaucrats. They're not presidential appointees. They're people who are part of the federal bureaucracy, many of them holdovers for the Obama administration. These are the people who have been roadblocking EMP national preparedness for years. And so they're slow-rolling critical reports that already were supposed to be due but haven't been delivered. They're lowballing the threat. They're ignoring, trying to overturn the Department of Defense and EMP Commission assessments of the threat that were that have been around for 60 years and replace them with new threat assessments that are based on junk science provided by, guess who, the electric power industry. People like the Electric Power Research Institute, the people who gave us the crisis in California. But in effect, if they prevail and they allow the field strengths to be estimated at the low levels for both natural EMP, that is solar superstorms, or nuclear EMP attack that they want to do, in effect, the industry would have to do little or nothing, and DHS would have to do little or nothing in terms of changing its contingency plans. You know, it could continue to act as if an EMP would be no worse than a hurricane.
And the practical effect of all of that, Peter, is to put, as we've been discussing, the entire country at risk of similar, much worse, actually, problems to what we're watching playing out in California right now. This is utterly outrageous and unacceptable. And you write in this article that with, quote, the resignation of several key people at the top of the National Security Council staff, it is at best uncertain that the replacements will have the knowledge, experience, and drive to see that the president's executive order is implemented, especially in the face of the resistance from career bureaucrats in league with domestic and foreign electric power monopolies. Peter, we're going to have to leave it at that, but that is such a chilling quote. I pray that you personally, and you do deserve credit, not just for that conversation with the president when he was campaigning, but for all the hard work you've put into this topic for so long. We need your advice and counsel inside the senior, you know, leadership offices in the United States government. I pray that will be the case, and look forward to working with you to that end. In the meantime, thank you. Come back to us soon if you would. Ken Timmerman is up next. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. A man that has been covering battlefronts in this war for the free world for decades, in fact, been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for his work on one of the most important of those fronts, Iran, as the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, is Ken Timmerman. He is a man of many parts, a nationally recognized investigative reporter, the author of numerous books, including Deception, which is about Hillary Clinton and Benghazi, and novels, and so much more, as well as, of course, his featured commentaries and columns in a variety of places. We are always privileged to catch up with him and glad to do so specifically in the context of what's been developing of late in Syria, which he has spent some time in over the years with Kurds and otherwise. Ken, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me on, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Well, you have of late been writing some pieces that are quite interesting, quite provocative. I'm not sure I completely agree, but I'm very anxious to have you tell your side of this story about the president's stance with respect to Syria and pulling U.S. forces out of there, and the impact on and the nature of, well, going forward, our relationship with the Kurds with whom we had been fighting, ISIS, there. Tell us your thoughts.
Well, Frank, you know that I have spent quite a bit of time with the Kurds. I know leaders from all four of the Turkish, of the Kurdish areas in Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Iraq. I've been in their training camps in the Kandil Mountains, which is 12,000 feet along the Iran-Iraq borders. I have a great deal of sympathy for the Kurds, but the United States of America never signed up to establish a Kurdish national homeland. Now, maybe we should, but that's a separate discussion. But we've never signed up for that. By the way, the Congress has never agreed to a U.S. military deployment in Syria either. This is not congressionally authorized. So I think the president's pulling a couple of dozen troops away from the border was actually a smart thing to do. And those who said he should have kept them there to confront the Turks, and I have no love for Erdogan and no love for what the Turks are doing, but those who said that we should have kept those troops there to confront the Turks aren't really thinking this through. So we're going to use 25 or 50 U.S. soldiers as a tripwire. We're going to sacrifice them. We're going to say we're going to take 10 of them will be killed, 20 of them will be killed. And then what are we going to do? Declare war on a NATO ally? That's the problem. People haven't really thought this through. The president continues to have very close relationships with the Kurds. Those troops have redeployed to the Al-Tanf area, which everybody pretty much acknowledges is strategic in the three border region between Jordan, Iraq, and Iran. It's also the key to two very important things. The oil in northern Syria, which the president is going to make sure goes to the Kurds, and to blocking that land bridge that the Iranians have endeavored to open over the past 2-3 years from Iran through Iraq into Syria and onto the northern border of Israel.
So with respect to the territory that's been relinquished as a result of all of this, Ken Timmerman, tell me about what's happening there. The Turks are now there in force, I take it. You have no love for Erdogan, the president of Turkey, neither do I. What has that teed up in terms of the impact on the local population, Christian and otherwise, and perhaps Turkish ambitions beyond Syria? Erdogan is said to be desirous of becoming the next caliph of a new Ottoman Empire. What do you make of all of that?
Well, I think that's true. And I think Erdogan has made his goal and his desire very clear. He has built a 1,000-room palace in Ankara to welcome all of the member states of the caliphate in the future. So his ambition is clear. I happen to think that he's bit off more than he can chew. He has established a generational struggle in northern Syria. If he follows through on his threats to resettle Sunni Arab populations into Kurdish, traditionally Kurdish and Assyrian Christian areas, he is setting off a generational struggle. All of his support for the Palestinians, you know, it's wonderful. You hear Erdogan cry his crocodile tears for the Palestinians who want to return to their so-called homeland. Well, this is an area in northern Syria that truly is the homeland of Syrian Kurds and Assyrian Christians. And if Erdogan replaces them, because he has already displaced them from their homes with his invasion, if he replaces them with Sunni Arabs, this will be a generational struggle. And we will have war for the next 1,000 years. And by the way, that's what the president was warning about. These are not our wars. These are tribal wars that have been going on for thousands of years already.
They certainly have, Ken Timmerman. One facet of those wars, however, is one that we have felt rather strongly is part of the struggle that we have with what I call Sharia supremacists more broadly, specifically the Islamic State, or ISIS, as it's been known as well. What is happening there as a result of these movements? Are, as we've been told, those who were incarcerated by the Syrian Kurds now being returned to the battlefield? What is likely to flow from that? And can we rely on Erdogan to keep a lid on ISIS in the absence of our forces and the Kurds in that specific region?
We couldn't rely on Erdogan to keep a lid on ISIS even with our forces in the region, because Erdogan is at the creation of ISIS. I've written about this in the New York Post and other places. It's at kentimmerman.com. You can find this out. It is terribly well documented, Frank. We've known this since 2012, really. Erdogan and the Turkish intelligence service were there at the creation of ISIS. They have created a safe haven for ISIS in Turkey. They've created field hospitals for them. They were buying the oil that ISIS was stealing from Syria for many, many years. And this was being done through Erdogan's own family. So, no, I have no confidence that Erdogan will put a lid on ISIS. Some of those prisoners that you mentioned have been freed. They have escaped from prison. My understanding is that around 100 of them have escaped, and they have been integrated into the pro-Turkish Syrian militias that are operating in the Turkish controlled areas. So you're going to have a resurgent ISIS under Turkish control in northern Syria. It won't be the ISIS we saw before with a territorial caliphate. It will be masquerading as Turkish-backed Syrian forces.
Mm. And that constitutes, I think it's fair to say, a serious problem, not just for the Kurds or for the oil in the region or for that matter, our friends in Iraq, but it's a problem for us as well, is it not, Ken Timmerman?
It is, Frank, but it was happening already. So the fact that pulling out those 50 troops was irrelevant to this. It was happening already. It was going to continue happening. And now what we've done, the president has done, is pretty much draw the battle lines. He said, okay, we're going to leave that area. You, Mr. Erdogan, you said that you have a real national security interest there. By the way, that's also a false argument. There has not been a single attack against Turkish territory from that area in northern Syria where the Kurds were before. So there haven't been terrorist attacks across the border. But the battle lines are now clearly drawn. And I think the president, when he meets with Erdogan next week, has got to make it very, very clear that Erdogan has to sever his ties with ISIS. And by the way, he should be severing his ties with the Islamic State of Iran.
Yeah,
as well.
No kidding. Well, this is, I guess, the big concern, Ken, is that the signals that have been sent, including this opening of the White House to Erdogan, may well be very much contrary to that kind of tough love, if you will. It's certainly needed at the very minimum. I personally believe that we ought to be looking at getting them out of NATO as well, given that they really are an ally no more. That's a subject for another day. I did want to just very quickly ask you, Ken, about the fate of Christians in all of this, particularly at the hands of Erdogan and the other Sharia supremacists with whom he's associated.
The Christians are terrified in northern Syria. They have moved away from those areas where they have traditionally lived. There's a long history of this, Frank. In 1915 to 1919, the Turkish state exterminated Assyrian Christians, Armenian Christians, Greek Orthodox Christians in these same areas. And these are the descendants of those who escaped in the caravans of the deportation, the first genocide. So, yes, they are very afraid.
They should be, indeed. And we should be standing with them, I think, is the key point. Ken Timmerman, we have to leave it at that for this moment. I hope you'll come back to us with further updates in the near future. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.